Shiva. Our next speaker is Sophie Jiko. She did her undergraduate work at the Sorbonne and is now doing a PhD in philosophy at the Université Amiens. And she has interest in Austrian philosophy, literary ethics, Musil and Lichtenberg and Wittgenstein. And she's writing a thesis on satirical rationalism and moral perfectionism.
Thank you. So, today I'm speaking about Robert Musil's satire and satire which is sobering up moral thoughts. So you know that Robert Musil is chiefly known as the great author of the novel The Man Without Qualities, and recent studies in the last 30 years have enlightened the philosophical aspects of his works by focusing on his scholarship with Karl Stumpf, his PhD on Ernst Mach's epistemology, his studies in new psychology, his reading of Husserl, or his interest in statistics and probability theory. A philosophical content is brought out, and we can discern the features of Musil the philosopher behind Musil the novelist. Now, Musil himself began to analyze his inner dilemma between philosophy and literature, or as he said, I quote, between his brain and his medulla oblongata. His diaries bring to light the unceasing hesitation and show that he certainly wished to overcome such a dualism. So the question is, how can we express our moral thoughts? What tone should we use to talk about what matters to us? To what criterion do we refer when we speak of the right word? In this paper, I would like to focus on two aspects relating to the tension between philosophy and literature in Musil's works. My starting point is Musil's following diagnosis. On the one hand, philosophy, and especially logical speculation, deals with the maximal position with irrelevant things. We shall admit that for the ordinary man, fractals do not really matter. On the other hand, literature deals with important things, especially with our moral concerns, but its lack of exactness, its vagueness, and its vacuity are intolerable. Thus the question becomes, how can we express important things accurately? In other words, how can we express our moral thoughts rationally? First, I shall argue that the variety of tones in Musil's novel is the consequence of the opposition not so much between philosophy and literature as between the philosophy of life and rationality. In fact, the philosophical tendency to adopt a lyrical tone arouses a second tone in the novel, the satirical tone. The analysis of the novel shows that satire works as a deflationist tool in order to purify the uses of language. Through quotations, Musil tries to spot impostures in order to respect his demand for exactness and authenticity. He begins to rectify our way of speaking. Secondly, the satirical technique has not only an aesthetical value, but also an ethical one, all the more so as Musil thinks that aesthetics is ethical. In this perspective, the resort to satire appears to be a moral exercise for mental health. Indeed, Musil is accurate to the tension between reason and feelings in him, and he wishes to protect himself from several temptations, the seduction of the philosophy of life, romantic enthusiasm, Begeisterung, as well as amoral or immoral skepticism, egoism, and merciless positivism. So let's begin with the satire of the philosophy of life. So in his diaries, Musil develops explicitly his intention to adopt a satirical technique of narration. In his early notes, he already refers to the Aristotelian poetics, and definition of satire, and he seems to agree with the idea of an educational art, which would be moralist without being didactic. Literature is seen as, I quote, an interpretation of life. It tries to suggest partial solutions to implement in the moral field of action. Musil does not really explain what he means by satire, but he considers his great novel as a satire, comparing his work with Stendhal's. He describes satire as, I quote, an imperfect imitation, or a situation when the usual constraining aspect is slacking off. Considering his readings and his milieu, I should suggest that Musil inherits Oskar Krauss's conception of satire. Krauss was his contemporary, publishing a satirical journal called Die Fackel, The Torch, and well known in all the Austrian intelligentsia. He considered that satire had the moral task to spot impostures. Like Krauss, Musil regards himself as a moralist and satirizes through quotations. In the city definition, slackening corresponds to a contextual change. There is a transfer of words and speeches from reality to the fictional world. In the novel, each character seems to be reduced to the megaphone of a contemporary type. Indeed, Musil shapes his fictional characters so that they should represent the main intellectual types of his time, and he prefers a literary form instead of a philosophical treatise because fiction offers the possibility to test philosophical abstract thoughts. The resort to satire allows Musil to take theoretical thoughts literally and to take philosophers at their words. Most of the characters in The Man Without Qualities are types of the prevailing philosophy of his time, the philosophy of life. The present difficulty to read Musil relies on the multiple references to a philosophical trend which is almost forgotten, but was in vogue between 1880 and 1930 in Europe. In brief, the philosophy of life is centered on a metaphysical notion of life which is never precisely defined. Life implies spontaneity, immediacy, feelings, emotions, authenticity, experience, and intuition. This trend includes various thinkers whose common points are the exaltation of subjectivity and the opposition against the predominant stages of reason, understanding, abstraction, and scientific positivism. The idea is to distinguish between dead thoughts and living thoughts. The first ones are abstract products of a calculating, disincarnated reason, whereas the second ones are provided by personal experience. Consequently, the variety of tones in Musil's novel does not rely on the dilemma between philosophy and literature. We cannot say that the satirical tone should be the philosophical one, and that the lyrical tone should be devoted to literature and poetry. I'd rather suggest that satire attacks the lyrical tone of the philosophy of life, when it is question of soul, mysticism, intuition, and so on. And on the other hand, even if most of the novel's characters belong to the nebula of the philosophy of life, there are also characters who are representative of the opposite philosophy, positivism, which defends, in the novel, an instrumental conception of rationality. These characters are also satirist targets, even if they never speak lyrically. Reading the notebooks can help us understand the function of satire. Musil was a diligent reader of all the prevailing scientific works of his time, as well as the works of philosophers belonging to this philosophy of life, such as Maeterlinck, Ehlenke, Nietzsche, Emerson, or Spengler. He was seduced by the precision and the clarity of scientific works, as well as by the relevant questions of the philosopher I just mentioned. Therefore, it seems to me that the satirical tone emerges every time that Musil feels tempted by such positions, whereas he is conscious of their limits. Satire plays the role of a deflationist tool, which breaks seductive illusions. A few examples among the fictional characters should make this point clear. For instance, Diotima. She is a compound of Maeterlinck's and Ehlenke's quotations. Ulrich, the main character, which is also autobiographical, is charmed by his cousin and her romantic aspirations. But the satirical tone emerges to reveal the gap between the speeches and the acts of a woman demanding authenticity. On the one hand, she feels a strong desire of purity, and she would like her soul to reach the higher level of a kind of ecstatic vision. And on the other hand, she's troubled by her own sexual attraction to the industrial and philosopher Arnheim. The satirical writing reveals that the first desire is fed, in fact, by the sexual one, since Arnheim is the defender of an ecstatic vision. So we do understand that Diotima's interest in metaphysics is more linked to her sexual motivation than to an intellectual or moral need. The satirical text catches her eye on the fact that the edifying discourse of the pure soul and high vision of truth is suspicious. Furthermore, Satire reveals the imposture of a so-called metaphysical quest, which is actually based on sexual attraction. Ulrich mirrors Musil's own hesitations and temptations, as we can read again in the diaries. The meeting with his sister Agathe leads to refocus on the prevailing concept of the other condition, der andere Zustand, so that the second volume clearly reflects the attractive power of the philosophy of life. Ulrich is disappointed by the amorality of both skepticism and positivism, which leads sometimes to immoral egoism and even malice. His concerns about moral questions such as how should we live, what is a good life, or what is the right attitude we should adopt, plunge him into despair. Science is unable to answer the most important questions. The philosophy of life focuses on moral concerns through its propensity for mysticism, love and generosity, but vaguely. The task of fiction becomes to test philosophical principles in order to verify if they can be applied to reality. The result is not satisfying. Ulrich, trying to prolong the other condition, which means a condition of disinterestedness and pure love, sets out on a trip to an island for holidays and has an incestuous relationship with his twin sister. So the enchanted parenthesis ends with bitterness and disappointment. Therefore, the variety of tones is linked to the tension between the demand for rationality and the ideal of authenticity and self-reference. Consequently, Ulrich evokes mysticism, I quote, half grave, half mocking. His ethical meditation is characterized by, I quote, an oscillation from coldness to emotion. Obviously, Musil has been haunted by this tension he tries to put into words with a great diversity of metaphors. Some quotations. I'm having a close look at the way to saintliness, wondering if I could drive on it. Or, it was like Icarus waxwings, which melted at altitude, he exclaimed. If we wanted to fly not only in a dream, we had to learn to do it with metal wings. So every time that the pursuit of authenticity is corrupted, and leads to emphatic swelling. The satirical turn appears and quotations are deflated by the confrontation with reality. The technical element of driving stops the edifying effect of the word saintliness, as well as the metal, referring to technology and modernity, breaks the spell of the lyrical reference to mythology and Icarus dream. A third character is emblematic of the satirical attack on philosophy, Clarissa. Clarissa is inspired by Musil's friend, Alice von Charlemont, who married one of his best friends, Gustel Donat, Walter in the novel. Clarissa is all the more typical of the romantic attitude as she is pathological. She is the Geistert and seems to be possessed by a strange demon, Nietzsche himself. In fact, she wishes to apply literally Nietzsche's aphorisms to her life. And this attempt leads her to a kind of Dionysian delirium. She is convinced that she might be Nietzsche's Superman, to such an extent that she feels hermaphroditic and provided with a strange power. She thinks that she can communicate silently with nature. Her hysterical behavior makes her ridiculous, and the satirical quotations are enough to strip her of all credibility. However, through Clarissa, fiction tests nothing less than Nietzsche's philosophy. Musil is a fervent admirer of Nietzsche, but he has the feeling that he may be fooled by the philosopher's writings. The aphorisms open to a lot of possibilities, without subjecting anyone to the test of reality. Musil suspects Nietzsche's work to be only words, expressing nothing practical or inapplicable to ordinary life. Should one of the greatest moralists be incapable of dealing with our moral concerns? Fiction is a good way to imagine what it would be to follow Nietzsche's precepts. And the fact that Clarissa appears as one of the most ridiculous characters in the novel is not in favor of Nietzsche. So Clarissa, our last example, reveals Musil's recurrent fear of enthusiasm. Indeed, his need for authentic silliness and disinterestedness leads him to a kind of mysticism, and he observes with anxiety the decline of religion, and the lack of something else to deal with moral aspirations. The need for moral guidelines is partially responsible for the success of the philosophy of life. Musil's project is to elaborate a new ethics, which has nothing to do with the constraining generalities of morals. He wishes to find an order without constraint, a kind of step-by-step ethics, able to stick to particular situations and to protect authenticity. The culture of authenticity is extremely important in Musil's time. His personal tension is linked to the will to conciliate the exactitude of reason with the culture of authenticity, and to the credo that it is possible to express authenticity rationally. Authenticity is too often relegated to lyricism and poetry, instead of being taken seriously and precisely. Ulrich reproaches above all the other characters for being typical of their time, and consequently conformist. His own meditation aims at freeing himself from the ambient conformism in order to feel truthful to himself. In this attempt, satire plays the role of the guardian of authenticity. I propose to refer to this attempt as Musil's moral perfectionism. The orientation towards moral perfectionism is determined by several moral foils: the two abstract and general morals of idealism, the impracticability of the precepts of the philosophy of life, the immorality of positivism and science, the alienation of pure authenticity. Clarissa is not the only character which is representative of a perverted authenticity. The murderer, Moos Brugger, is also the result of the separation between the claim of authenticity and the rational safeguard. Moos Brugger is fascinating because he is totally freed from the logical moral system of our society. He elaborates his own private logic, and during his trial, he tries to justify his murder with implacable coherence, even if people find it totally unacceptable. His desire for authenticity is so strong that he prefers dying rather than being considered as alienated. The lesson to draw from Mosbrugger's story is the necessity to renounce to extreme and exceptional behavior, so that the figures of the saint and of the murderer are both false. The solution is to be found in ordinary life. The satirical tone devaluates such extreme aspirations. Giacimo's aspiration to mysticism, Clarissa's pan-faced impressions, Mosbrugger's desire for pure authenticity. Thus, the satirical technique is more than a literary device. As Musil concedes in his journal, he tends unconsciously to express himself with a satirical or ironical tone, and he finds himself peculiarly witzig, that's the German word. The concept of witz refers at the same time to the satirical tone and to a psychological faculty, able to bring a lucid and synoptic vision of relationships between things. To be witzig means to be accurate, to be a good observer, able to avoid illusions and also linguistic traps. It implies to maintain a critical distance in order to see things as they really are, and not to be fooled by words. In this perspective, satire is linked to this faculty of accurate perception, since the possession of the witz is responsible for a satirical mood. The witzish man is a satirist, since he does not succumb to the seduction of language and thought. Our desire for moral recipes and great edifying ideas leads us to fantasies. Musil uses satire as a moral and spiritual exercise in order to fight against the distortion of the human need for authenticity and moral responses. In addition, we should remember the influence of his reading Aristotle and Plotinus, as well as his references to Stoicism. His personal investment in his own novel and the satirical aspect of the autobiographical character show that he considers satire as deeply ethical and as a kind of practice. Satire is not only a technique, but also a way to remain authentic. Moral perfectionism would not be possible if satire did not protect the demand for authenticity from the exhilaration of false solutions and deceptive temptations. So Musil is very sensible to the power of words, and especially to the fact that the expression of a thought can have a practical effect. That's why Ulrich is so angry towards the members of the Parallel Action, an association created in order to organize the Emperor's Jubilee. The Parallel Action only speaks, suggesting more and more extravagant ideas without ever acting. Satire tries to purify our practices of language, of all the anti-metaphysical roots and inapplicable theories. It obeys two requirements: the correspondence between roots and reality, which is the condition for truth; the correspondence between speeches and acts, which is the condition for authenticity. With this double constraint, satire is used as Occam's razor, and I shall suggest that Moses' moral quest is not so far from a kind of negative theology. The advantage of such a position is to hold together, on the one hand, faith and moral quest, and on the other hand, a refusal of the illusions of language. Moses' perfectionism seems to be an unceasing meditation on moral values, watching over authenticity, and it might be seen as a kind of secularized negative theology. So to conclude, since the use of language is a kind of practice, the satirical use of language is to be seen as moral exercise in Musil's life. Musil belongs to this tradition of moralists who tried not only to elaborate relevant critics or theories, but also to behave according to their convictions and to find the right way of life. If literature offers the possibility to test theories and to satirize illusions and false pretensions, the satirical tone is not confined to literary works, and it is also a pitch of philosophy. Musil applies satire's critical distance to his personal life in order to distinguish between relevant and fantastic interpretations of experience. In the pursuit of happiness and authenticity, it is sometimes useful, maybe necessary, to resort to satire in order to sober up moral thoughts and to remain lucid. Thank you.
Sophie's paper will receive comments from Peter Polner in the philosophy department here at Warwick.
Well, thanks very much, Sophie. I found this a really illuminating way of reading Musil as a moral perfectionist, and to try to interpret the peculiarities of his style in terms of this perfectionist project. I want to pick up on one point in particular in your reading, namely the role of satire. I mean, the one thing that I was slightly doubtful about in your, well, perhaps two points, but they're connected. The primary point that I was slightly doubtful about in your reading, I think, was in your interpretation of the style of Musil as primarily a satirical style. My own sort of preference for here would have been to say that Musil is an ironical writer, perhaps even more than a satirical writer, while recognizing, of course, that the boundaries between these two sort of styles are quite fluent. There are satirical passages in books 1 and 2 of The Man Without Man Without Qualities, but I think, to my mind, they tend to be the exception. What's predominant is an ironical style. I've actually got two passages here. I've even got a handout. So, I mean, if you, as examples of satire and irony, I think these are, you may find these quite interesting. Now, I think the second passage here. This is about a party of the intellectuals. Remember, the context of the story is that there's this campaign going on in Vienna in 1914 or 1913, run by various influential society figures, to bring back the spirit or culture into soulless modern civilization. And as part of this campaign, we get a series of meetings of various intellectual circles. And here we have a description of the party of the avant-garde artists, who are also being consulted about how we might bring back, you know, culture into modern civilization. And this is a satirical passage, I think. It's the second one in your handout. And perhaps I won't read the first one, but I'll just read this second one, this satirical passage. This time it had been an extremely entertaining party. Very many of the guests were under 30, many no more than 35, all still with a little of the bohemian clinging to them, but also already with some reputation and noticed by the newspapers. There were guests from abroad, from far and wide, who had been attracted by the news that in Kakania, a lady who moved in the highest circles was blazing a trail for the spirit to make its entry to the world. What terrific slogans they had. Technicism, a spirit worthy of the age of the machine. Blériot, one of them had exclaimed, was at that moment soaring over the English Channel at a speed of 35 miles an hour. This 35 miles an hour poem was what one ought to write and chuck the whole rotten rest of literature onto the dungheap. And then one of them said that man was a mysterious inner space, for which reason he should be brought into relation with the cosmos by means of cones, spheres, cylinders, and cubes. But the contrary was also asserted, namely that the individualist conception of art underlying the aforementioned opinion was already as good as dead. We must give the coming generation a new sense of habitation by means of communal architecture and settlements. And while in this way an individualistic and a social party had formed, a third intervened to say that only religious artists were in the true sense of the word social. Hereupon a group of modern architects demanded the leadership for itself, religion being in fact the aim of architecture. The religious group, reinforced by the cube and cone men, objected that art was not a dependent but a central matter, the fulfillment of cosmic laws. In the course of further discussion, however, the religious group was abandoned again by the cubistic one, which now united with the architects in the assertion that the relation to the cosmos was best expressed, after all, by spatial forms that made the individual element valid and typical, and so on and so on. This passage goes for about two pages. Now it's obvious that Musil is satirizing here various forms of contemporary avant-garde art. I mean, there's almost explicit reference to Kandinsky's On the Spiritual in Art here, to cubism, to futurism. And it's a satirical passage, I think, because as typical for satire, and it's a deflationary mode of speech which works by undermining what is said through the manner in which it is said, or through providing a context to what is said, which makes that content appear false or inappropriate or otherwise objectionable. And it does that typically, this deflation of the content, by simplifying or exaggerating. Typically relies on, thereby, a pre-existing shared understanding of what would be appropriate or ethically acceptable or plausible. And in this case, you can easily see how this simplification and exaggeration works. The views of the cubists, the views of the abstractionists, even the views of the futurists, are simplified, they're exaggerated, they're not given a proper hearing. And their claims appear obviously exorbitant and ridiculous. I mean, they all want to make a claim to be the redemptive force that brings back the spirit into despiritualized modern society, which is dominated, as Dautimo always said, by mere logic and psychology. So it's exaggerating, it's simplifying, through which this appealing implicitly to a shared understanding of appropriateness that makes this passage satirical. Now often, as I think this passage does, satire appears facile and actually unfair. And it's because the exaggerations or simplification that he uses can always be contested as capturing the essence of what's actually being satirized or parodied. It's also perhaps worth saying that satire very often tends to be conservative, precisely by relying on a sort of shared outlook or code or practice which allows you to recognize the inappropriateness of what's being satirized in this exaggerating, simplifying mode. Now, I want to say that this is untypical for the first two books of The Man Without Properties, and that the typical mode is actually one of irony. I won't read this passage out, but you find a nice example where the man without properties himself is being ironized in the first passage on my handout. Irony, I think, is a mode of speech that deflates also, but in a way that's much easily pinned down. It has, so to speak, what I want to say is that in irony, it's very often unclear just what it is that's being undermined, as indeed in this first passage here. What is it that's really wrong about young Ulrich? So irony has, so to speak, an exploratory aspect. Something is being undermined, but we're not quite sure what it is. What is it that's really being criticized here? Something seems to be inappropriate about Ulrich's behavior, but what is it? Now, crucially, also irony often includes a kind of duality or ambiguity. The Romantics, Friedrich Schlegel, in particular, described as a kind of hovering and oscillation between destruction and creation. It reminds me of something that you said, Sophie, about Musil himself being oscillating in his relation to the philosophy of life, for instance. There's an attraction to the philosophy of life, but there's also a disavowal or a rejection. And this is expressed in this ironical mode of writing about the philosophy of life and many other things besides. So instead of speaking as the Romantics did about an oscillation between destruction and creation, it's perhaps better, at least in this Musilian context, to speak about an ambiguity between a disavowal and a complicity. So it seems to me that when Musil is writing about modern culture, the predominant tone is precisely this ambiguity, a disavowal and a complicity. But why is it that this mode of writing in books 1 and 2 is, as I would claim, predominantly ironical? And here I think we come back to one of your central claims in your interpretation. The way you described it by saying that Musil is situated really between, and he addresses, a fundamental fracture or fission in cultural modernity. He seems to stand on both sides of that fracture. On the one hand, modernity as essentially rationalization, the way Max Weber had described it, of course, a very standard orthodox view, concerned primarily with the attempt to obtain clear and distinct representations of the world through, for example, conceptual analysis or through development of a univocal language that allows us to come up with clear and distinct gnomic representations of the behavior of the items in the world of nature. So rationalization on the one hand as distinctive of modernity, and on the other hand a rebellion against this, which of course was virulent at the time when Musil was writing, as represented in Vitalism and the Philosophy of Life. So an inchoate sense that something essential is occluded by rationalization and by modernity. And Musil stands on both sides of this divide. And hence, I think the ironical mode of writing. Now, if we ask what it is that the neo-romantics, the vitalists, and so on, thought was occluded by modernity, they, of course, come up with all these different descriptions. Diotima, Hansek, and so on, all these different spokes, Clarissa, you mentioned her, the Dionysian character, and they all have different descriptions of just what it is that's wrong with modernity and what it is that's occluded by it. Its subjectivity, its feeling, its wholeness. We're alienated in the world, so we're no longer at home in the world. Musil distances himself from these descriptions that the neo-romantics and the vitalists give of the problems of modernity, because they're all anti-rationalist. So they all think that either there's something wrong with conceptual thought. The Dionysian variant, or perhaps Bergsonian, I'm not sure. Or there's something wrong with unconstrained rationality. So this is the conservatives. Diotima and her circle want to go back to tradition or drug Kampfleinsdorf, and to go back to tradition and so on. And I think what Musil disavows is this self-understanding of the disenchantment and the alienation with modernity. He doesn't want to buy into that criticism of modernity. But he is complicit, and hence this ironical mode of writing, he's complicit with the aspirations, which are somehow inadequately expressed in these vitalist and neo-romantic philosophies. The aspiration, if you like, towards wholeness or towards an overcoming of the nature, because he actually agrees with the diagnosis of modernity. What he doesn't agree with is the prescriptions for overcoming its problems. So what he wants to keep in plain, and is both a sort of conceptual, and I think this is really totally in agreement with you on your conclusion here. What he wants to keep in plain is both conceptual clarity and rationality, and the acknowledgement of the limited nature with respect to our most fundamental aspirations. So Musil is in a sense committed to both aspects of modernity, both rationalization and its criticism, as we find it in vitalism and a lot of other cultural phenomena since.
Maybe I can give an answer. No, it's the concern for me to precise this distinction between satire and irony, which is part of my PhD, so I can say a few words. My starting point is clear distinction between satire and irony, where satire supposes a distance between me and the satire's target. So it supposes that the satire's target is external to me, whereas irony is kind of is self-referential. So that's my starting point. Irony is directly turned on the self. But both are techniques of self-conduction. That's why I consider that both are part of what I call moral perfectionism, because they are both techniques of self-transformation. Since, and I quote Stanley Cavell, when I criticize my society, that's me who I am criticizing. So satire and irony are deeply connected, and this is part of the same aspiration to try, and that's the second remark, so trying to remain truthful to yourself and at the same time being intelligible for the others. And being intelligible, that supposes that you keep a certain rational form or a kind of intelligibility, so kind of something that can be generalized in some extent. So that's Musil's attempt. And this attempt to conciliate the culture of authenticity and rationality is, for instance, in a more historical plane, brilliantly explained by an author like Charles Taylor in Sources of the Self, for instance. He tries to depict the history of this conflict between rationality, between this two main sources of ourselves, and so the culture of authenticity and the rationalist requirement.
I'd like to come to your defense a little bit about satire too, because I'm not a Musil expert, although I do work with him a little bit. I think that his use of satire goes beyond the test in two ways. And I think this probably goes without saying, but it can't be said enough, that an important thing about Demonon Eigenschaften is that it is 2,000 pages long, has no plot, and is unfinished. And that's something that probably everybody knows, but it's very, very important to the two ways in which I think the satire of it go beyond the text. One is it goes beyond the time period of the text, back in time to the Vienna of the mid-19th century, where Viennese double perspective was the way people talked on stage, like Nestroy, so I'm thinking of right now, where it was just the way that it was thought that you were entertained during this period of intense censorship was that you could come up with this piece that could be taken straight and ironically at the same time, but in doing that, you were performing an act of satire, satirizing the people who might not think that you were smart enough to know what you were really doing. And so it has this, like, it's different than irony, I think, the sort of, the way that Der Mann ohne Eigenschaften is so indicative of a particular time in Austria, is such an Austrian text. The other way I think it goes beyond the text is what I hinted at before with the length and plotlessness of the structure of Der Mann ohne Eigenschaften satirizes the novel. It lampoons with total contempt, but hilariously so, the idea that a novel has to be possible to read by a normal human being and have some sort of plot. And so I think that that sort of radical skepticism has a sort of detachment that I do believe is, I think that it is a satirical project on many, many, many levels at once. I suppose that's not much.
Yes, I totally agree. Yes, you're totally right. Musil uses satire as in reference to Karl Krauss's performances, and he sees satire as a technique in a corporal sense. So it's a performative use of language, and concerning his conception of the novel, you have to read what he writes about Thomas Mann, which is more than satirical, it's a pure jealousy. But so you see that he's really engaged in his life to try to do new experiments on the new experiments, but not so new, because he is really influenced by the essayistic writing of somebody like Emerson. That's true. So my idea was not to analyze only the Austrian tradition, which is already much and much commented, but the other tradition that connects Musil to Emerson through Maeterlinck and Nietzsche. This is also a very interesting perspective.
Well, that's not much of a question, but I don't know. When you said at the very beginning, fiction offers the possibility of testing abstract philosophy on notions.
Yes.
That's what you said.
So
I wonder if you could say a bit more about this notion of testing there, because the way you develop the papers and that, we could certainly thematize rationality, both rationality and irrationality, in the philosophical framework. By philosophy. So what is it that literature provides as an extra element that allows the testing? Is it just a manifestation of irrationality? Another possibility would be, for example, to do this testing in absolutely practical terms by sort of applying this Nietzschean aphorisms in your life, seeing whether they're right or wrong, whether they work or not. So what is it that is special about the realm of literature in terms of this testing?
Yes. So in the novel, which is a very big novel, you have many attempts and which are explicitly designed as utopias. Ulrich tries several utopias, and not only irrational utopias. One of his major utopia is the utopia of exact life. So he tries to live with as much exactitude as possible, and it leads him to evacuate his moral concerns because he cannot reach exactitude in this field. So he is led to abandon this first utopia. And in the novel, every time that he tries to test a rational, not a rational moral theory, but rational behavior, rational principles of behavior, the text becomes theoretical. And he didn't manage in this novel to give concrete examples when he tries to be more precise in his idea of what it is to be moral, what is a good life, what it is to act as fair as possible. So, but the novel is unachieved and finished, so. Every time he becomes again theoretical and he tries to be more rational. And the only concrete examples are examples of irrationality, that's true, like Clarissa. Yes?
Could you possibly clarify something for me? You said at the end that both satire and irony are kind of a technique for self-transformation, but that makes them, doesn't that make them both self-referential? Whereas you said if you said satire presupposes some kind of distance, and how can you have that distance if they're both acting on yourself at the same time?
Yes, because even when you satirize your society, you are compelled to admit the idea that you are doing nothing to change your society except criticizing it. So in such an extent you are in a kind of conformist attitude. And that's why, for instance, Cavell calls the paradox of consenting. In such, in a way, you criticize your society through satire, and in another way, you are taking part to this society. So,
I could follow up on that because a question I had was, you said a lot about how Musil was trying to live his life, and Peter meant used the word committed to. Sort of both sides of this modernity, neo-romantic hostility to modernity trends that were going on. I'm having a hard time figuring out how a guy actually crafts a way of life for himself out of that, so as it just lives kind of split, if not actually confused, or in any case wavering. I got the impression from your talk that you wanted to explain this as an authentic and whole way of life. And I'm not quite seeing how that's possible given the attitude of, on the one hand, critique, on the other hand, a longing to be a part of something that you can't quite make yourself part of. It sounds a bit more tragic than capable of being whole in the way you seem to want.
It reminds me of a quotation from the novel when Ulrich is thinking about himself, and he's saying, in this deep wavering, there was something unwavering that was not courage, that was not bravery, but the capacity to cling to oneself. And this conflict is experienced by Ulrich, and I suppose by Musil himself. It is indicated in his diaries. And you have a first temptation, which is this temptation of skepticism. And this is the mainly satirical moment in the novel, to be roughly speaking, the first volume of the novel. And with this idea of negative theology. But the negative theology is not the final solution, since when the main character, Ulrich, meets his sister, he abandons this skeptical temptation to try to, through sacred conversations, to be truthful to himself. But even if in this attempt, sometimes, when he expresses his wish to be truthful to himself, becomes too lyrical, skepticism comes again, and the satirical tone emerges again. so.
But is the overall feeling then, I mean, so clinging to that could suggest, well, this is me, this is all I've got, I'm going to deal with it, which would be kind of negative. On the other hand, I could see a positive reading of that, which is, this is me, and I accept myself fully. Now, is it even between those two things, is there this wavering in Musa, or does he fall on one or other of those two sides, would you say?
He stays in this wavering because he feels, for instance, the danger for him is to become as Mosbrugger. As Mosbrugger, the murderer in the novel. Mosbrugger is who he is, and he is totally truthful to himself, and he is the permanent foil for Ulrich. So. And at the end of the novel, there is another final utopia, which is only sketched. It is the utopia of inductive mentality, where Ulrich and Musil wonder if finally, if we are not determined only by the social state, the social condition, and we have no choice and no authenticity in our choices. And it's a very pessimistic conclusion. If we read it as a conclusion, it's very pessimistic.
I hate to close on a pessimistic
note. No,
but I think we should stop now and thank our speakers. We are a little behind time, but let's have a break. There should be coffee that way down the hall again. And why don't we try to reconvene at 10?